Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. The Supreme Court of the State of Wisconsin is now in session. Silence is commanded. Please be seated.
Well, good morning. Some of you ventured out, didn't think you'd get caught by the snowstorm, huh? Do you suppose we'll have... I'm a gardener, so I keep wishing away the snow. We've had enough for me, but Mother Nature may not be ready to give us spring completely. My notes tell me that we have students from Manitowoc Lincoln High School with us. If that's correct, would you all please stand? Oh, wonderful. You may be seated. The students are here on a program called Court with Class that we operate in conjunction with the State Bar, so they know a little bit about the case that you're going to be arguing to us today. And students, if you can remain after the second argument over the lunch hour, Justice Annette Ziegler, who sits right over here, will come down and chat with you a little bit, not about the substance of the case, but she'll tell you a lot about how cases get here and what we do when they do get here and so forth. So if you can stay, please do. And anybody else who wants to stay, everyone certainly is welcome. Okay, so to call our first case, State versus Garcia. Counsel, are you ready to proceed? Please do.
May it please the court, my name is Pamela Morsehead, and I represent Nelson Garcia. I guess I'll start at the beginning, which is the first issue presented in the briefs in this case, the issue of Mr. Garcia's right to counsel at the lineup. And there's probably some tenet about not beginning by saying what you're not arguing, but I think that it's important that I do that in this case, because I think there's been some confusion about that that has persisted. So to be clear, Mr. Garcia is not arguing that the probable cause proceeding that happened in this case was adversarial, or that he had a right to counsel at that hearing. It's very clear, the state is correct, that he did not, that that proceeding itself is not an adversarial proceeding. What Mr. Garcia is arguing is that that proceeding initiated adversary criminal proceedings such that he had a right to counsel at all critical stages that followed that hearing. And the court in Garcia and Rothkary made it very clear that those are two separate questions. The court said the question whether arraignment signals the initiation of adversarial judicial proceedings is distinct from the question whether the arraignment itself is a critical stage requiring the presence of counsel.
Counsel, is a CR 215 review ever done when someone is arrested pursuant to a warrant?
No.
Okay. So how is the review, the paper review, different from what a judge does when he reviews the submissions before signing a warrant?
It actually is not substantively different. The difference is that the defendant at that point is in custody, and at that point there's been some decision made that he's going to be held beyond that 48 hours requiring that probable cause determination. When an arrest warrant is issued, when that determination is made by a judge, the defendant is not yet in custody.
Okay, when he's arrested pursuant to a warrant and taken into custody, at what point is he afforded counsel?
So I think that first of all, under Rothkary, the fact that probable cause determination has been made, that at that point the complaint has been filed, because the warrant cannot be issued until there has been a complaint in Wisconsin. So at that point, the complaint has been filed. Restrictions have been placed on his liberty. So I think that under Rothkary, at that point, the right to counsel would attach. I would also note that under this court's precedent in Jones, that once the complaint is filed and he's in custody, the right to counsel would attach. So I think that's not a question that this court needs to answer here, but I think that's the answer to that.
So there's no other ways someone can be arrested, except when a complaint has already been filed? A warrant won't issue unless there's already a complaint filed?
That's right. Under Wisconsin statutes, the complaint has to be filed in order for the arrest warrant to be issued. Most arrests happen without a warrant, as the arrest in this case. So most of the time there has not been a complaint filed, as here the arrest happens, and then the question is he going to be held more than this 48 hours? And if so, that triggers these proceedings that have to happen.
I just want to be sure
that I understand what your position is. And so your position is, if someone is arrested pursuant to a warrant, because the complaint has already been filed before the arrest warrant is signed, that as soon as that person is arrested, a right to counsel attaches. So he has to be appointed counsel right then.
The question isn't whether he needs to be appointed counsel immediately. The question is whether he has right to counsel at any critical stage that follows. So, for instance, in Rothkerry, the court didn't answer the question, how quickly does counsel need to be appointed? The question that the court answered was, does he have a right after that to counsel at any critical stage?
Okay. So then the question was, what is a critical stage, right?
Right.
Okay, very good. I understand.
The right attaches at that moment.
That's right. So there's some confusion about what does attachment mean. Attachment only means that after that point, if there's going to be a critical stage, that he needs to have counsel. And
you have the right to counsel, but you also have the right to represent yourself. I mean, let's just assume that there was a warrant, he was arrested on it, he was brought in for an initial appearance. You don't necessarily, you might have a lawyer at the initial appearance, but you might not. Some defendants invoke their right to counsel, some do not. And then the case proceeds on. So, I mean, even if it were that situation, I suppose you could put off the initial appearance, but most people like to be advised of the charges, have a probable cause determination, if it's not a warrant, and then have bond set or whatever and move forward. But I view this, and you've got to help me with this, I view this very much like a warrant being issued. And when I've done these, and I don't know who else on the bench has, maybe everyone has, but I doubt it, it wasn't my preferred way of proceeding. I preferred to have the complaint and the warrant and read, know what it was people were doing, or evaluate the complaint as it came in after someone was arrested without a warrant. But occasionally you're reviewing paperwork instead. And I view that much like the process of a warrant issuing in the first instance. You agree that you don't have the right to have counsel at the time a judge would issue an initial warrant, right?
That's right, because at that point, whether you're looking at Jones, whether you're looking at Rothkerry, the defendant is not, no restrictions have been placed on his liberty, is the language that's used in Rothkerry. So just the mere fact that there's a warrant out there and the defendant is out on the street, he doesn't have a right to a counsel that attaches until there's been some restriction placed on his liberty.
So and then is it your position that anytime someone's in custody, they immediately...
No. I think that under Jones... And this question is not addressed in Rothkerry, but I think under Jones, the fact that the complaint has been filed, which commences the criminal action or criminal suit, and the defendant is in custody when the warrant process is used. So a complaint has been filed in the warrant, and then he's arrested. I think under Jones, he would have the right to counsel attaching at that point, which is not to say that he can't waive it. So the Supreme Court decision in Montejo makes it clear that there's no presumption that a waiver of the right to counsel after that would be invalid. So the defendant can always waive the right to counsel. It has to be a knowing and intelligent waiver of a known right, but he can always waive the right to counsel.
So Ms. Morrishead, I understood your argument, though, to be that this what happens during this proceeding, this Riverside proceeding that they conduct in Milwaukee County, is akin to what happens when an arrest warrant is signed, because the complaint won't have been issued yet, but that the right to counsel would attach to any critical proceeding after this occurs, similar to the way the right would attach after an arrest warrant once someone's arrested. Is that correct? Because Jones seems to stand for the proposition, and it's pretty clear, I can quote the language, if the line of demarcation is to be definite, the complaint or the warrant must be issued. And it says or. So I guess what I'm asking you is to distinguish, I know that the procedure is to file the complaint with the warrant, but aren't you really arguing that it's the process of the probable cause determination coupled with the loss of liberty that occurs either at an arrest warrant stage, after an arrest warrant stage, or after this probable cause determination at Riverside occurs?
That's correct. I don't see a functional difference, really, between those.
So the complaint itself, although that's part of the process, that's another way, of course, prosecutions can begin, but you're really putting this akin to what Jones gives as an alternative, that this right to counsel attaches either at the complaint or the warrant issuance stage.
Right, and that's under Jones, and I want to make it clear that Jones sets a different starting point for the initiation of criminal proceedings than does Rothkerry. And to the extent that it does that, Rothkerry overrules Jones. And what I mean by that is that Jones requires the complaint to be filed, the criminal action or lawsuit to be commenced formally in court. Rothkerry plainly did not require that. Rothkerry required that the defendant have a first appearance before a magistrate at which he was informed of the charges against him and at which restrictions were placed on his liberty. It did not require the filing of a formal complaint, and in fact, there wasn't one in Rothkerry. And
so it's the machinery of the prosecution being turned on, correct?
Right. And Rothkerry made it clear that machinery can be turned on just as well by as by a prosecutor. A prosecutor's involvement is not necessary. And I should point out that under Texas law, Texas statutes, there was no complaint filed in this case. It wasn't required. That a police officer can't initiate a criminal lawsuit under Texas statutes any more than he can in Wisconsin. So it isn't as though in Texas police officers are empowered to formally begin criminal cases or criminal actions. They're not. What happened there was exactly what happened here, which is prior to that happening, the defendant was arrested without a warrant. This proceeding happened where there was a formal accusation, just as here, filed by a police officer. Here we had a sworn accusation by a police officer that was reviewed by a magistrate to determine probable cause, and restrictions were placed on his liberty. That was all that was required in Rothkerry.
So following up on Rothkerry, the court said that we reaffirm what we have held before and what an overwhelming majority of American jurisdictions understand and practice. A criminal defendant's initial appearance, initial officer, where he learns the charge against him and his liberty is subject to restriction, marks the start of adversarial judicial proceedings. So at a probable cause hearing, I believe the state refers to as the Riverside hearing, has there been a charge made against the defendant?
Yes, as that term is understood in Rothkerry. So I think part of the confusion here is there are all these words being thrown around that have statutory meanings in Wisconsin and different meanings in the Supreme Court case law, words like charge, initial appearance, arraignment. In Rothkerry, it's clear that when the court was talking about a charge, they were talking about exactly the same thing we have here, which is a police officer filing an accusation. It referred to an accusation. There is no support for the idea that they meant by charge what we commonly understand in Wisconsin to be our criminal procedure, which is a complaint is filed and that's when a person is charged.
I want to turn back a little bit to what you were talking about before. I believe you said that the right to counsel does not automatically attach upon arrest. Is that right?
That's right.
Okay. But in every arrest, let's say the proceeding here in Wisconsin was a little bit different. You didn't file a complaint first. You just go and you have a probable cause hearing to issue an arrest warrant. Isn't that making an accusation or a charge against the defendant?
If there was just a warrant filed, then I would say yes, because there was a sworn accusation by a police officer that led to that.
Okay. And then the right to counsel would attach at that point?
It would attach after he was arrested. So right. you need all of these things to be present. You need the charge, and you also need the restraint.
So the right to counsel does always attach upon arrest?
No.
Okay.
Well, because let me back up just a second. So most arrests happen without a warrant. So in that instance, the right to counsel would not attach upon arrest. It doesn't happen until this proceeding is held to determine whether there's probable cause. So, you know, theoretically, a police officer could arrest somebody, hold him for 36 or 42 or 44 hours, and the right to counsel would never attach, because if that hearing was not held, that probable cause hearing was not held. In the warrant situation, it's a little bit different because the probable cause determination precedes the arrest. But that's the exception rather than the rule.
All right. So your rule is at the point at which someone makes a probable cause determination, the right to counsel attaches at that point.
When there's been a probable cause determination and a restriction on liberty, I think. And, you know, like I said, Rothkiri doesn't really answer the question in the warrant context. The person is in custody and there's no proceeding being held after he's arrested. I don't think that's a question this court needs to answer in this case, because it's not the case that we have here. What we have is an arrest without a warrant. I do think that it's a little fuzzier what happens when there's a probable cause determination that happens before the defendant is even in custody. But I think it's very clear under Rothkiri that if the defendant is arrested and then this proceeding happens. And I do want to say, because I have been referring to this proceeding throughout as the Riverside proceeding, and I think that's like sort of the common shorthand, but it's not exactly accurate, because the proceeding that happened here not only involved the probable cause determination, but also the setting of bail, and neither Riverside nor Gerstein say anything at all about bail. So what happened here was kind of a hybrid hearing, which is allowed under Gerstein and Riverside, but it's a little more than strictly a Riverside hearing. So I think I want to point out that the state is focusing on the commencement of the criminal action, which the state says must be the point at which criminal proceedings are initiated for constitutional purposes. And the court in Rothkiri made it clear that that is not required. The court said an initial appearance following a charge signifies a sufficient commitment to prosecute, regardless of a prosecutor's participation, indictment, information, or what the county calls a formal complaint. So there is no requirement of some kind of formal charging document that initiates a case under Rothkiri. To draw an equivalency between the word charge in that case and the word charge in our statutes, or initial appearance in that case and initial appearance in our statutes, is to draw a false equivalency. So I keep returning to Rothkiri. The bottom line is that what happened in Rothkiri is really identical to what happened here. The only the state and the Court of Appeals have taken two different approaches to distinguishing or attempting to distinguish Rothkiri. And the state focused on this idea that there has to be a formal action commenced, which really tracks Justice Thomas's dissent in Rothkiri. Justice Thomas's problem with the majority opinion in Rothkiri was that he believed that the founders intended that the Sixth Amendment didn't apply until there was a prosecution commenced, which meant the filing of a formal action. That was Justice Thomas's position. That was the dissent, and I think that's what the state is essentially arguing here.
Would you please
did
address?
Rothkiri,
go ahead. That's
thank
fine.
You. Did Rothkiri modify or overrule any part of Kirby?
No, I don't think that it did. I think what Rothkary did was took Kirby, the principles of Kirby, and applied them to this new situation. So at the time when Kirby was decided, we didn't have these hybrid hearings that were happening before cases were initiated. There was no requirement under, you know, Riverside and Gerstein that there be this probable cause hearing. So I think all that Rothkary did, and that's what the court said it was doing, was continuing the principles announced in Kirby and the subsequent cases.
Right. So let's take a step back and look at Kirby, because I'm not entirely – Rothkary seems to turn entirely on Texas criminal procedure, and I'm not fluent in Texas. So let's deal with the principles the court talked about in Kirby, where it said the initiation of judicial criminal proceedings is when the government has committed itself to prosecute – and when the adverse positions of government and defendant have solidified. It's then that a defendant finds himself faced with the prosecutorial forces of organized society. So I'm wondering how that fits into a probable cause hearing, and how that, how you would say that commits the government to prosecute that individual, and how that would indicate that the adverse positions of the government and defendant have solidified.
I think that it does because the court in Rothkary specifically said that it does.
I'm not entirely sure Rothkary is really helpful here. That's dealing with Texas criminal procedure. And frankly, I don't know Texas criminal procedure. So why don't you walk me through how Wisconsin criminal procedure maps onto what Kirby was talking about.
So Kirby had the same basic holding as Rothkary, that, and I'm quoting, that the right to counsel attaches at or after the initiation of adversary judicial criminal proceedings, whether by way of formal charge, preliminary hearing, indictment, information, or arraignment. I mean, it's important to note, again, that arraignment doesn't mean this proceeding that we have somewhere down the line in our Wisconsin statute. That term arraignment is used interchangeably in these cases with terms like initial appearance.
Right. So help me understand how, whether we call whatever this probable cause hearing was a Riverside hearing or not, tell me how that probable cause hearing caused the government to commit itself to prosecute and solidified the adverse positions of the government and defendant. Because, I mean, my understanding is there's been no complaint filed at that point, right?
That's right.
Okay. And the court is not telling the defendant that he's been charged with anything.
That's right.
Well, doesn't he tell him that he's been charged? He gets handed this piece of paper saying bail was set. These are the charges against you.
Thank you. So again, I've just fallen into the question of charge and what does that mean? He's not been charged as we understand that under Wisconsin statutes. He has been charged in that he's been accused.
Right.
Formally.
And he's been told here's why you're here, right?
Yes.
Okay. So tell me how that commits the government to prosecuting and how it solidifies the government and defendant's adversary position. And in particular this, there is a subsequent proceeding in which the state will decide what charges are we going to bring against you? And it might decide, there's nothing there.
So I will answer your question, I promise, but I can't without making reference to Rothkary. And the reason for that is because in Kirby, the court did not at all address this question of a Riverside-type hearing or some kind of hybrid hearing. The court in Rothkary applies Kirby to that situation. And this language, I think, is very important because the state made essentially the argument that you're suggesting, which is that that how can the state have committed itself to prosecute just by having arrested somebody and held them for a little while when there's no formal complaint? It cannot be that we've committed ourselves to prosecute every time someone's arrested. And the court said the answer, though, is that the state has done just that. Subject to the option to change its official mind later, the state may rethink its commitment at any point. It may choose not to seek an indictment in a felony case, say, or the prosecutor may enter nolle prosequi after the case gets to the jury room, but without a change of position, a defendant subject to accusation after initial appearance is headed for trial and needs to get a lawyer working whether to attempt to avoid that trial or to be ready with the defense when the trial date arrives.
Right, but here's the problem that I'm having, just going back to not knowing Texas criminal procedure. That analysis may follow entirely from what Texas criminal procedure is. Maybe in Texas, once you have that hearing that they had, that it inexorably follows that the state will prosecute. And maybe that's not true here in Wisconsin. Right? So we've got to make sure that we're comparing apples and apples here, and I'm not sure we are.
So I would say two things to that. First, if that were true, it was not dispositive in Rothkary. That is, Rothkary did not mention that as being any kind of prerequisite. Second, looking at the Texas statutes, they have a criminal procedure code that isn't too dissimilar from Wisconsin's. I know a little more about Texas law than I ever thought I would need to or wanted to. But in Texas, there is the Article 15.17 hearing, which is at issue here. And that that hearing is in a statutory chapter called arrest, commitment, and bail. And then there's a statutory chapter called after commitment and bail and before trial. And that section lays out the procedure for either a grand jury or for the state to file an information or a complaint. The information and complaint in Texas are filed at the same time under Article 21.22 of the Texas Code, and those things happen later. So it's laid out very similarly to Wisconsin, except that they have a specific statute covering this hearing where we don't. So there wasn't any requirement that a complaint must immediately follow this hearing, and there was no complaint filed in this case. So I think the court in Rothkary makes it clear that that police officers, by filing this affidavit and evincing an intent to hold somebody beyond that 48 hours, can set the machinery of criminal prosecution in motion, whether a prosecutor knows about it or not.
Well, it's not just, you're not really arguing it's just the police that do it. It's the neutral magistrate that steps in to do it, right?
That is, sure. So the police officer sets it in motion by filing the accusation, and then the right, of course, would not attach until the neutral magistrate had reviewed it and in our proceeding set bail.
Counsel, I had wanted to ask you about your issue of Mr. Garcia being denied his right to self-representation, and your time is gone now, but if you could think about addressing that when you come back.
I will do that.
Okay, good. Thank you very much.
Good morning. May I please the court? I'm Kate Lloyd, representing the state.
Counsel, Rothkary says a criminal defendant's initial appearance before a judicial officer, where he learns the charge against him and his liberty is subject to restriction, marks the start of adversary judicial proceedings that trigger attachment of the Sixth Amendment right to counsel. How is this probable cause hearing in this case not fit into that category described by Rothkary?
It's not an initial appearance.
Does the label control, or what we do at that hearing?
Well, what we do certainly controls over a label, but as this court said in State v. Koch, I think it is, that the probable cause determination required by Riverside is independent, can be independent from an initial appearance. There's no requirement, unlike an initial appearance, that a defendant have a right to be present. And clearly in Rothkary, the defendant was present, and it's a different animal. That's 15.17. Sounds like it's the equivalent of our initial appearance to me. and what happened to Garcia in this case as a probable cause determination for the Riverside wasn't an initial appearance.
So how does that map onto Rothgary? Because your opposing counsel says this is exactly what happened in Rothgary. You show up, you have a police officer that says something against you, the neutral magistrate repeats that something against you, and then your liberty is restricted. Right to counsel with matches. How is this different?
Well, it's not the same proceeding. It's what Gerstein and Riverside were concerned with was excessive detention based on warrantless arrests. So it's a Fourth Amendment consideration. And to protect that, we now give defendants a probable cause determination by a neutral magistrate at which they're not afforded the whole panoply of rights that they're given later on. And one of the things that Riverside and Gerstein were so concerned with is that those probable cause determinations be held so quickly and that somebody weigh in to make sure that no one's liberty was being excessively curtailed. And they knew that if, especially Gerstein, I think, talks at length about this, that if the attachment of rights were greater rights, like Sixth Amendment rights, were to attach at that point or at the stamping of the probable cause determination, then further, then it would delay the process. 48 hours wouldn't be enough. I was reading the oral argument transcript in Riverside last night, and that's what the county talked about at length, because in Riverside County, they had combined their preliminary examination with their probable cause determination, and so it had delayed their ability to get the defendant's counsel. And so that's why the Supreme Court divorced the probable cause determination from the initial appearances and preliminary examinations so that there would be a quicker resolution to a determination.
So in Rothgary, was that first hearing that Rothgary was at, was that a Riverside hearing?
No, I don't think so.
Okay. And what components were involved in that hearing that distinguish it from a Riverside hearing?
He was present.
I'm sorry?
He was present.
Okay, why does that matter?
Because he was, there's no requirement at a Riverside hearing. It can be completely ex parte and usually is. So I think that there's also language in Rothgary, if I just may.
Yeah. While you're looking that up, I would imagine that's also true in the probable cause hearing to issue an arrest warrant, right? The defendant's not there, and yet the right to counsel attaches upon taking him into custody after an arrest warrant, right?
Because of the complaint. But he's then given notice of the charge, which he isn't in this case because there is no charge.
Well, where do you get that from? Because when I read Jones, it's very clear that our line that we've demarked is either the filing of the complaint or the arrest warrant.
Right. And I think that there's some I think that that language isn't I would ask you to clarify that language because I think it's the complaint. And I think that, as opposing counsel says, there really isn't a mechanism in Wisconsin for an arrest warrant in the absence of a complaint.
Well, so you would ask us to overrule Jones.
I would ask you to clarify that or there's a
or
it's
means
or no, warrant is warrant and complaint. There isn't a way to have an arrest warrant without a complaint. So it's almost redundant to say complaint or warrant is like saying complaint or warrant with complaint.
Well, couldn't there be an independent meeting if we assume, if the Jones court was simply assuming that a complaint is always on file before the arrest warrant issues, but that there are people taken into custody without a warrant, right? And a complaint is filed sometime after that. It could be that Jones was saying there are two points at which this attaches. The arrest warrant, because we already know there's a complaint out there, or if you're arrested without a warrant, at that point at which the state files the complaint.
Sure, although I think it would be clearer just to say complaint, because in either case, complaint would clear it up. But that could be what Jones meant.
Counsel?
I'm sorry. I didn't want to stop you mid-sentence. Were you mid-sentence?
Go ahead.
Or at the end. You just were discussing initial appearance. And, of course, your opposing counsel said, careful of these labels because initial appearance may not mean in some of the jurisprudence the same thing that we think of here in Wisconsin. Your immediate response to an initial question, and I use that term guardedly, was this is not an initial appearance. But I look vis-a-vis Rothbury. They weren't talking about an initial appearance. But I look at the very first sentence of the opinion, and it suggests to me that initial appearance terminology is not a term of art, but meaning the first. And because I say that, because this is what the very first sentence of Justice Souter, who authored the opinion, what he wrote. This court has held that the right to counsel guaranteed by the Sixth Amendment applies at the first appearance before a judicial officer at which a defendant is told of the formal accusation against him and restrictions are imposed on his liberty. So isn't Rothbury really using initial as to mean first, as they did in their first sentence of the opinion?
Well, a few things about that. I don't know that I disagree with that, but he didn't appear. So it wasn't his first appearance before a judicial officer. So I don't know how that could square with what happened at a Riverside. And then, two, in that same sentence, is told of the formal accusation. So I know that we differ here on what a formal accusation is, whether or not it is just an accusation by a police officer in a police incident report, or if it's a complaint. And that's a big difference between us. But I think that the reason that it says formal accusation is it is something more than this. And I think that if Rothbury intended to overrule Riverside or clarify that a Riverside hearing is when or right immediately after, when the right to the Sixth Amendment counsel attaches, it certainly could have done so.
In response to my question, does Rothbury mean by initial appearance what we have, used to have in Marathon County on Monday mornings with all of the people from the weekend in for an initial appearance, or does it mean first appearance?
I think that that sentence, taken as a whole, means the first time the defendant has appeared in court when a complaint has been filed.
How do you distinguish one of the problems we have here is the tension between cases, and I specifically reference the cases from the Eastern District of Wisconsin, West, let me point to that case, which essentially says, look, this is form over substance requiring a personal appearance. The same sort of thing happens, and that was essentially, I'm paraphrasing, the holding of West, that you have a deprivation of liberty, you have the charges because they're dispersed, the information is given to the defendant, you have a judicial officer making a probable cause determination. So West says that's just a formality if you're requiring personal appearance. Could you respond to that, please?
Well, I think that the decision's wrongly decided. I think that's a misreading of these cases in combination. As I just said, I think that if the Supreme Court had wanted to say that the Riverside hearing, after the Riverside hearing, is the attachment of the Sixth Amendment right, it's had 30 years to do so, and it hasn't. And I think that when you read Rothbury as a whole, it says repeatedly that it's just an extension of, it's just reading Kirby, and it's the formal judicial adversary proceedings have started, and nowhere has anyone said that that's at a Riverside hearing. And part of the concern in Rothbury was that he had learned of these criminal charges against him, and it had been public, and that then he was out and he couldn't get a job, and all these, the criminal prosecution had begun against him, and with that, the whole weight of the government and all of those problems had affected him. And none of that is true after a Riverside hearing.
After a Riverside hearing where you've been told of the charges and you're now being held on bail, none of that's true, that the weight of it is not against you and you haven't...
You haven't been charged. You're not, like, an employer wouldn't know. I mean, they're...
Because you're in custody, probably, right? But the employer, I mean, all right, so you're making a distinction based on actually showing up, so you really put a lot of...
No, I'm making a distinction based on he hasn't had an initial appearance and there hasn't been a complaint.
So if someone wanted to have a Riverside, so you're saying if there was a Riverside hearing and they did have the defendants appear, then the right would attach, but if they choose to have a Riverside hearing without a defendant being brought physically into court, that then the right does not attach. You're making that distinction.
No, there's no complaint.
So now you're, so it's based on the complaint.
Not now. I've said consistently throughout that Kirby and Rothgerry all say formal accusation. In Texas, there is some odd procedure in my mind that a police officer can do it. But if you look at the language that the case cites, it would defy common sense to say that a criminal prosecution has not commenced against a defendant who perhaps incarcerate awaits examination on the authority of a charging document filed by the prosecutor, less typically by the police, and approved by a court. It, throughout the decision, it talks about the charging document. We can disagree, as we apparently do, that the police incident report is the charging document.
No, it's the CR-215. That's not the incident report.
Okay, well, okay.
That is a formal court document,
right,
that has a, it's a swearing, an affidavit essentially of the police officer, and it's the finding by the neutral magistrate that that states probable cause, and it's the setting of bail.
Okay, in I'm not sure how to say it, Gouveia, the U.S. I actually took it up here. It's a Supreme Court case where they've said that they have never held that an arrest is when the right to counsel attaches.
Well, and it doesn't.
Right.
It's not the arrest.
But in Wisconsin, then 48 hours it would attach.
No, only if there was a neutral finding. I mean, that not all people go through this Riverside hearing. Many are released. Charges are often brought, but if you're going to hold somebody after 48 hours, Riverside requires this neutral magistrate to take a look at it and to make a finding of probable cause, and they set bail.
Right, and the Supreme Court has said that they don't require it at arrest, and they don't want to get involved with, they've rejected the arguments that prosecutors are constitutionally obligated to file charges against a subject as soon as they have probable cause, but before they believe that they can establish guilt beyond a reasonable doubt.
Right. And the prosecutor doesn't have to file the charges. They can change their mind.
And that prosecutors must file charges as soon as they marshal. And the purpose of the Riverside is to make sure you're not being extended without your liberty, without some Fourth Amendment protections.
Riverside challenges or Riverside hearings don't always occur in court, right?
This was a court commissioner.
Mm-hmm.
So tell me a little bit about when Kirby talks about the adverse positions of government and defendant having solidified. You mentioned earlier that this does not qualify as a hearing upon which the right to counsel attaches because he was not there. He did not appear. And I'm wondering the significance of that in terms of the government and the defendant's positions having solidified. At that point in this case, did anyone know anything about what the defendant's position was?
The defendant's position?
Right. So Kirby talks about the right to counsel attaching inter alia upon the solidifying of the adverse positions of government and defendant. I mean, I suppose it's possible that a defendant could say, yeah, you know, you got me, I'm subject to arrest, and by the way, I did all that. But we don't know. We don't know what the defendant's position is because he's not appeared, correct?
Right.
Okay. So what I'm wondering is there any sense in which Kirby's description of adverse positions having solidified, is it possible for that to happen when we haven't heard from the defendant yet?
Well, I guess I would, it would, I'm not going to say that they're not adverse to each other, being the police and the defendant.
I mean, certainly as a matter of question of custody, it's adverse.
Right.
Right? But is that the adverse positions that Kirby is talking about?
I don't think so. I mean, it's, the delay here from the Riverside to the lineup was about 5 hours. And my understanding is that Milwaukee County in particular does not want to charge anyone until they've done the lineup because they don't want to prosecute someone unless they know that they can be identified and that those witnesses are reliable enough to show up. So this is done for the for everybody's purpose, really. Mm-hmm. So there was nothing nefarious here about not having counsel or delaying this. It was brought for – this is just how it was done. Everybody I don't think there's anybody that doesn't think that counsel at a lineup is a fine idea. There's no reason I can think of not to have counsel other than maybe administrative concerns and timing. But I know that the Seventh Circuit has said that in a pre-indictment stage where there's no presumption to counsel under Kirby, there's a rebuttable presumption that the defendant can, if the defendant can show that the delay was for some purpose to avoid the appointment of counsel, that's one way to approach it. But I see all of the law, even Rothbury, as saying that there needs to be a complaint or an indictment or an information, something more than a PC finding by a commissioner under Riverside.
Counsel, just been discussing Kirby and the phrase adverse positions have solidified. That's the description. Solidified adverse positions. But after, it seems to me, after Riverside, that Rothbury altered that a bit. It didn't speak of adverse positions being solidified, but rather, quote, marks the start of adversary judicial proceedings that trigger attachment of the Sixth Amendment right to counsel. So that's the language that marks the start of adversary proceedings.
It says the Sixth Amendment right of the accused to the assistance of counsel is limited by its terms. It does not attach until prosecution is commenced. Mm-hmm. As for purposes of the right to counsel, peg commencement to the initiation of adversary judicial criminal proceedings, whether by way of formal charge, preliminary hearing, indictment, information, mm-hmm. or arraignment.
But it doesn't speak of solidifying. That's what my point. It's kind of marking the start of... There's something else that you seem to take the position that Riverside does not require, or Riverside does not set in motion accusation. In other words, that the defendant was not accused within the meaning of the Sixth Amendment at that time. So here's my question. If he hadn't been accused of anything, then why is he sitting in jail with a $50,000 bail amount and a form that said there was probable cause to believe that he had committed robbery of a financial institution and a parole violation? So there just seems to be a tension that I feel with your argument that he was not accused within the meaning of the Sixth Amendment under the facts of this case. $50,000 bail in jail.
Because the prosecution hasn't commenced. It's the Sixth Amendment attaches when the prosecution has commenced. He has other rights. He has Fourth Amendment rights, and he has Fifth Amendment rights at this point, but he doesn't have the Sixth Amendment right yet.
So that's, you're kind of embracing, even though the words may not appear, you're embracing this solidifying as opposed to initial judicial proceedings. I mean, this could be an initial judicial proceeding. It's before a court commissioner, and a court commissioner is a judicial officer, so maybe it hangs on some of that difference between solidifying and Kirby and Rothgerry post-Riverside taking a little bit different approach.
I think that there's a reason that they repeatedly use the terms formal charge and information and complaint and preliminary examination and never say a Riverside proceeding or a probable cause determination. Mm-hmm. I mean, it seems odd to me that if they meant to say a 48-hour probable cause determination, the Supreme Court would say a 48-hour probable cause determination marks the initiation of a prosecution.
Even if those weren't the facts brought to them, though, why would they say that if those weren't the facts?
I'm not sure where it says that those are the facts.
I'm saying they're not. They weren't in Rothgerry, right?
I'm sorry?
Why would they say something? You're saying the Supreme Court, the absence of it means it's not true. The Supreme Court, just like us, we only deal with the facts that are brought to us. We're not going to make some broad statement today about some other proceeding that's not this proceeding. So if this case hasn't been brought to them, I don't understand the argument.
In Riverside, they repeatedly said that this doesn't afford all of these rights. So are you, I mean...
It doesn't afford these rights. That's the part where when we first started out, and your brief was different, so I think that's why Ms. Morse had started out that way. We're not saying that the rights attach at the Riverside proceeding, which is what Riverside said. The argument here is after that, they have been initiated. The right attaches after. That wasn't the case at all in Riverside. There was no reason to discuss when the right, the Sixth Amendment right to attaches, right? After the Riverside proceeding, that wasn't an issue.
Okay, but then I guess I'm confused because if the issue is bail and the restriction on liberty, it seems like it would be at this proceeding.
No, there's no argument that's being made that I hear that at this Riverside proceeding that Mr. Garcia had a right to have an attorney. He absolutely does not.
But then I don't understand how it is tied to Rothgerry, because that was the proceeding that he needed the help with setting the bail and all of that.
It attaches after. I mean, that's the argument being made. I'm just saying that's
the argument
being made.
The argument is because of the lineup, it attaches after. That's the critical stage.
The argument is that after that, there was a critical stage for which he didn't have an attorney present. Had he been brought into court afterwards for an initial appearance, he would have had an attorney present because they would have been appointed at that point. But in this time, there was a lineup, and there was no attorney there. So that's the argument, is that he had a right to have it because it attached at the...
But when at it? When the court commissioner stamped it?
Wait, it's stamped, it's handed to him, the finding's made, he's already in custody, and now he's being told there's probable cause about the charge, there's bail at $50,000, here are your charges.
So when it's handed to him then, so not when it's stamped.
Well, then we can ask Ms. Morehead that. I mean, I think it's the process that she's articulated, and I'm not making the argument for her. She's articulated that it's this two-piece. So are you're saying when is it physically? Like,
right, I haven't understood, and the positions have changed since the petition or since the Court of Appeals, and it has been confusing to me on when the point in time is that this is supposedly attached. And I think it's much cleaner, and I think the Supreme Court supports this, is when it is the charge. And I think Rothgerry says that. I mean, they say, I don't understand Texas procedure, but it says throughout the decision, the charge.
So would the charge, let me ask you this then, would the charge be when the prosecutor files their complaint or when they get into court if it's a day later or 2 days later? I mean, so that has the same kinds of issues, right?
Absolutely, but it's any critical stage after the complaint has been filed. So the complaint is filed, any critical stage after that filing.
But just to be clear, Rothgerry doesn't just speak about charges, and under the Texas procedure, there was no charging document filed by the prosecutor. It was an accusation by law enforcement, right?
It was a charge by law enforcement, and I don't know what that means in Texas. And I tried to figure it out, and to me, this 15.17 hearing, to the best of my understanding, is an initial appearance. And
well, Rothkerry also says what counts as a commitment to prosecute is an issue of federal law unaffected by allocations of power among state officials under a state's law. So they're not just making a ruling in Rothkerry applicable to Texas. It applies to all states. And it goes on in that same section of the opinion to say an accusation filed with a judicial officer is sufficiently formal. So that's different than a charging document, which, again, we don't have in Rothkerry.
But what they said was the question before them was whether the 15.17 hearing was what triggered the attachment. Was it that was enough? Their first question is, what, or their only question, the issue, is whether Texas's 15.7 hearing marks the point that adversarial criminal proceedings have begun. So they were examining what happens in Texas and whether or not that proceeding is what triggers the attachment. So it can't divorce it. Even though the question is one of federal law, it is what happens in that proceeding.
So are you saying Rothkerry only applies to Texas?
No, I'm saying that the court was looking at what happened in Texas to determine whether or not the Sixth Amendment applied at that point.
And you are saying in Wisconsin we have to have both an appearance and a complaint filed before the Sixth Amendment right attaches.
I would say that once the complaint is filed, any critical stage after that, whatever that means, whatever we've determined that means, what critical stages are.
So not necessarily his appearance, then?
Oh, I think probably his
appearance.
Well,
that's what I just said.
Yeah,
I thought
sorry.
Before
yes.
you had
just,
two parts, and I was wanting to be
just
sure
mean,
I understood.
It doesn't have to be his appearance. It can be other, you know, any pretrial stage that we determine is a critical stage.
Like a lineup.
Yes.
If a complaint had been filed, then the lineup would have been a critical stage, but it's not, in your view, because no complaint was filed.
Yes.
But there was no complaint filed in Rothkerry. There was an accusation by law enforcement, which is what we have in this case.
Again, I'm not familiar with the 15.17 hearing, but the Supreme Court said that that was a sufficient hearing or a sufficient mechanism to trigger a criminal prosecution start. And I would say the Riverside hearing in this case was not the start of a criminal prosecution.
Is it the state's position that as long as the state of Wisconsin keeps the accused out of court, then the right to counsel will not attach?
No.
Well, but if you had a Riverside hearing where the defendants are present, which some do, then would it attach?
No.
Okay, so even if you brought the defendant into court, you told him what he's being charged with, you set bail, and it's a Riverside hearing, it's not a full hearing, you're saying that now he doesn't have a right to counsel and they can go do whatever critical proceeding without that counsel present.
It's not a critical proceeding until charges have been filed.
Okay, so that's what you're saying.
Well, under your scenario, you just said he's been charged.
No, I didn't. I said it's the same thing. That's CR 215. I don't know how other counties do it. I know how Milwaukee does it. That's where I was. They don't have the person present. Other counties might have the defendant present during a Riverside hearing. So when we're talking about appearance and being present in court,
and I'm not.
So it doesn't matter until the complaint is filed. It doesn't matter.
Document, just like they say in all of these cases, the information, the preliminary examination, the formal charge, the indictment, or the arraignment. Repeatedly, the Supreme Court has said that. In Rothkerry, they say that.
Well, in Rothkerry, though, they also say an initial appearance following a charge signifies a sufficient commitment to prosecute regardless of a prosecutor's participation, indictment, or information. So in Rothkerry, as in this situation, we have only law enforcement involved at this stage.
In Rothkerry, they determined that what had happened at the 15-17 hearing was a formal charge. And my argument is that at the Riverside hearing in this case, there was not a formal charge. What had
Why?
Happened here was because it wasn't a formal charge, because it was just a PC.
What makes it a formal charge?
The complaint in Wisconsin.
Okay, but there was no complaint in Texas. It was just law enforcement accusing the accused.
And the Supreme Court said that under Texas law, that was a formal charge.
Okay, so their 15-17 hearing is equivalent to
our complaint in Wisconsin as you see it.
That's my understanding, yes.
Okay. All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I just want to hit a couple of points very briefly, and then I will shift my focus as you requested, Justice Robinson. The state makes a distinction between Fourth Amendment rights that Riverside was designed to protect and Sixth Amendment rights. The court in Rothkerry made it clear that you can't draw that kind of distinction. The court said the county rests this logic with the argument that in considering the significance of the initial appearance, we must ignore prejudice to a defendant's pretrial liberty, reasoning that it is the concern not of the right to counsel, but of the right to speedy trial in the Fourth Amendment. So you can't draw a distinction between Riverside and just say, well, that only protects Fourth Amendment rights if the substance of the hearing that is done is the initiation of criminal proceedings. Then that implicates the Sixth Amendment. With regard to this question of the defendant being present, it isn't mysterious. Article 15.17, it talks about the hearing that has to be held within 48 hours to determine probable cause. How that is any different from our hearing, except that it is laid out in a statute, I cannot understand. And it is important, I think, with regard to the personal appearance question, to note that Texas specifically allows that hearing can be done by video appearance. So even in Texas, the defendant doesn't have to be brought in. And if we're going to draw a distinction between an appearance, a physical appearance in court, and some other kind of paper appearance, then that puts in jeopardy the Riverside proceedings that are done in Milwaukee County and various counties all around the state. Because Riverside and Gerstein both require that the defendant be brought before the court. So if we're going to say being brought before the court, appearing in court, requires a physical appearance, then all of those counties that do that, the procedure that Milwaukee uses, have been violating Riverside routinely. it's a distinction without a meaningful difference.
Counsel, tell me a little bit about the first paragraph in Rothkerry, which says, this court has held that the right to counsel guaranteed by the Sixth Amendment applies at the first appearance before a judicial officer at which a defendant is told of the formal accusation and restrictions are imposed on his liberty. Now, your position is not that that Mr. Garcia had a right to counsel at the probable cause hearing, correct?
It is not, and,
okay.
And that is...
All right. Hang on just a second. But Rothkerry seems to be addressing a hearing at which the right to counsel attaches at that hearing.
The defendant in Rothkerry never made the argument that he was entitled to counsel at that hearing.
I know,
he
but
argued
I'm
that
looking...
that hearing triggered his right to counsel at critical stages thereafter, and therefore counsel needed to be appointed after that. And then
right.
The question was, how soon did that have to happen?
But what I'm looking at is what the court actually said. And they said that the right, the Sixth Amendment right applies at that hearing. So I'm wondering, again, just given my lack of familiarity with Texas procedure, whether that hearing that they were having there is the same kind of hearing that we're having here. Because Rothkerry said his right to counsel attached at that hearing, not after it, but at it.
So, you know, I think that's an example of some imprecise language, because I think if reading the decision, the Rothkerry decision as a whole, the court does not hold that he had a right to counsel at that hearing. The court holds that he had the right to counsel initiated after that hearing. That is, that hearing initiated the criminal proceedings such that he had a right to counsel after that.
Well,
the Rothkerry concurrence is actually... explain, there's a difference between attachment of the right and when the right to have counsel present occurs, right? Chief Justice Roberts explained that Justice Alito's concurrence correctly distinguishes between the time the right to counsel attaches and the circumstances under which counsel must be provided. Attachment signifies, under Justice Alito's concurrence, nothing more than the beginning of the defendant's prosecution. It does not mark the beginning of a substantive entitlement to the assistance of counsel.
That's right. The court made it very clear that these are two separate questions, and it was answering the second question. It wasn't saying that he had the right to counsel at that hearing. And Mr. Garcia has never argued that, not in the Court of Appeals and not here.
I'd love to hear the answer to Justice Rogenczak's question with respect to that fourth issue. I know you don't have a lot of, well, your red light's on, but since I asked it, maybe you can answer.
I doubt she can answer it in a sentence, but if you want to take a sentence, fine. Otherwise, I think the time has gone by.
Can you take a sentence? This is on the ineffective assistance issue.
Was there a specific question?
No, the question was to address his allegation that he was unconstitutionally denied the right to self-representation. And if you can do that in one sentence, fine. If not, you're probably better off sitting down. That's why I asked you to start
with
it.
Make it compound complex.
Right, right.
I wish I could do that, but I am not that skilled.
Right, right. That's what I kind of figured.
Thank you.
Okay, before we conclude the hearing, I didn't announce when we started. Justice Shirley Abraham's son, who usually sits here and once in a while appears by phone, is not appearing at all. She has withdrawn from appearance, so we sit six for this case. Thank you very much for good briefs and a really interesting issue. We are going to adjourn now for a little bit so another group of students can join us and another set up. We are adjourned.